Oh, I like how quiet it just got. Zen student approaches a river, and he notices that the water is deep, the water is rushing by. It's too dangerous to cross the river, and he sees a Zen master on the other side of the river, and he says, "Master, how do I get to the other side?" And the master says, "You are on the other side." I got another one. why did the Buddhist coroner get fired from his job?
What?
Right, very close, very close. He kept listing the cause of death as birth. Okay. So I want to back up a little bit here and actually go to the handouts in a coherent manner. So if everybody could open up to what will be the back of the second page. So the emphasis of today is really body, breath, and earth. Tomorrow we will get to emotions and each other, relationships. And really, my intention is to get a lot of the theoretical in over the next, for the rest of today and tomorrow. So Sunday we can just practice and have space. By Sunday y'all are going to be sick of me. And I'm going to want the luxury of not having to talk so much. And so we can just practice come Sunday. But so let's back up and talk about the body just a little bit more. So would somebody be so kind as to read the quote at the very top? Or do we need the microphone for this? Actually, here, I'll do it. I'll save us the trouble with the microphone. So Dan Siegel says, who is one of the more prominent neuropsych folk who are at the spearhead of the mindfulness movement, that presence is an actively receptive state. Right? I find those words to be very potent because they speak to what we were doing laying on the ground earlier, just simply relaxing and opening the body, right? That we're creating space. We're creating space to receive. And it's just like that deep listening that is so special that we spoke of earlier. There's an opening. And then but an active opening. It's not automatic. It takes intention. So it's an actively receptive state. Clarissa Pinkola Estes tells us that the body is no dumb thing from which we struggle to free ourselves. In proper perspective, it is a rocket ship, a series of atomic clover leaves, a tangle of neurological umbilicae to other worlds and experiences. Not an object, but a living other. And then from Diane Ackerman, to begin to understand the gorgeous fever that is consciousness, we must try to understand the senses and what they can tell us about the ravishing world we have the privilege to inhabit. And my hope is that each of you maybe had even just a nanosecond of bearing witness to this ravishing world that we have the privilege to inhabit for this short time as we were out there, ensconced in the beauty of this place, of the land. Right. So the Buddha also referred to the senses as glory fields, because your five main physical senses are always in the present moment. Right? A lot of talk about being in the present moment. Well, the body is always in the present moment. Mind, future, past, future, past, future, past, all day. Right. But body is in the present. Why? Or rather, how can we use that? So we have somatic meditation, which is really the name for what we did earlier at the beginning of today, and really is what we did in the beginning of this meditation, which is a little bit different from body scanning. If for those of you who hang out here at Spirit Rock more regularly, body scanning is a practice that's a meditation all its own. But with somatic meditation, we're really trying to join mind and body together. We're trying to inhabit the body as the mind itself, truly. That's the idea here, is that where is mind? Where is consciousness? You know? Meditation is famous as a practice of going within. Well, within where? For so long in my practice, I thought within was somewhere out here, right? I thought like spirit was like somewhere out here. We think of spirituality as being a path of up and out, right? And my teacher says it's actually a practice of in and down, right? So it's very interesting that we think of consciousness as being somewhere, I don't know, in the ether, right? And where else could it actually be other than the body? So very interesting neurological correlate of this is the fact that, well, we know that the brain is spread throughout the body, right? It's not just in the head. You have neurons and neurotransmitters all throughout the torso. You have a whole bunch of them in your digestive organs. We're waking up to this, that the gut is the second brain, and that imbalances in gut bacteria have been correlated to mental health and emotional disturbances, right? Interestingly enough, so psyche, which is actually the Greek word for soul, right? So we could say the brain is spread throughout the body. The brain is not the same as the psyche, but there is a correlation. They do go together. And interestingly enough, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says the soul is spread throughout the body. So the neurological correlation between all of this is that we also have two hemispheres of the brain. This is actually an antiquated way of thinking about the brain. It doesn't really work this way, so it's kind of just a clumsy way of talking about the brain that allows us to get somewhere. But we have two hemispheres of the brain, left brain, right brain. We know the left brain to be, it's really the source of that observing self, of that observing ego. It's the part of your brain that is overlaying your experience with a description, that's chattering, that's strategizing, that's making plans, that thinks it knows what comes next and is making plans around that. It's the part of the brain that goes blah, 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 blah all day. And then we go to the right brain, and we have a whole different situation there. It's more yin in nature, meaning it's more open, less linear, more attuned to symbols than it is literal objects. And it's non-linguistic. It's pre-language. It doesn't chatter. It's really interesting because folks are often driven to meditation because my mind is so busy. This thing will not shut up. It's driving me crazy, right? I get so sick of myself sometimes. I just want a little space. Right? And then they'll learn meditation as this thing we do from the shoulders up, right? Just pay attention right here. Lip service to the body, maybe a little bit in the beginning. You know, and then you're just working with thoughts, counting the breath here, counting the breath, labeling thoughts, all left brain activity. But the beauty of the right brain is, Dan Siegel says, we shouldn't even call it the right brain. We should call it the body, because it's the right side of the brain that is more in touch with the neurons and neurotransmitters and the peripheral nervous system, that which extends out to the extremities, than the left brain is. And so this very curious thing happens when we invest our attention in the body. We're actually turning on the side of our brain that is quiet. And it's pre-language, because it's that experiencing ego. It's the part of us that is directly in touch, that is always in touch with the present time experience. Isn't that nice? It's an actively receptive state. Presence is not something to be cultivated. It's something to relax into. It's something that's already here, waiting for you to catch up to it. It's not something we have to generate. Folks sometimes think about, I had a therapy client recently who said, I just want to show up in a powerful way. Well, okay, but showing up isn't something that you're going to, go and do. That's stress. That's causing tension. Feel that in your body. Oh, I'm going to manifest in this way that I'm imagining myself to manifest. Already there's a sense of I'm not good enough, and I need to be better. And necessarily, there's going to be a somatic reaction to that. That is contraction. It's the opposite of relaxation. Chinese proverb, they say, relaxation is who you are. Tension is who you think you should be. So to show up in a powerful way actually means the opposite. It means less effort. It means relaxing. It means allowing all the parts of you to just take a break. And then life itself can flow through you. So with having a somatic emphasis on in meditation, what we're doing is we're activating this quieter part of the brain. We're getting more sensually oriented in our experience. And then, to add to that, we have the truth of neuroplasticity, right? Which is a fancy way of saying we're changing all the time. It's quite fascinating to think about the fact that neuroplasticity is experience dependent, meaning that everything that you are either taking in through the doors of your senses or putting out through in the form of thought, speech, and behavior is leaving behind a trace of neural structure, is leaving behind something new in your body. Isn't that wild? That just me talking right now, there is new, at the microscopic level, but it's happening. And it's, over time, it has a cumulative effect. But as I'm talking, my body is changing in meaningful ways. It's kind of wild to think about. So, you'll see here on the handout, oh, I didn't include it. Right. So the opportunity here is to synchronize mind and body by investing our attention in regions of the body, sensing what is going on there, and then experiencing the living presence of the body, right, that has a life of its own. And then what we're doing, we discover the emotional material in our bodies. It's there, in the form of tension, in the form of denseness, in the form of solidity, in the form of sometimes things just come up to the surface quite spontaneously. You'll feel into a tight spot, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But then we also, through experiencing the tension of the body and releasing it, it's actually empowering. Oh, I don't have to walk around in a state of contraction all the time. It takes very, very little, actually, to relax and open the body. I can just lay down and breathe. You know, massages are great. Yoga classes are great. But we actually have more power to impact our state of being than we think that we do sometimes. Body is in direct relationship with the earth, and we can rediscover that. Mind is quieter when we are embodied. And then we get distracted and have to return over and over again. And through that, we can stay longer and longer. And the returning over and over again and staying present longer and longer, what we're necessarily doing that through the magic of neuroplasticity is we're ingraining a habit to live from the right side of the brain more and more. We're actually invoking that ability to be on that side of the brain by being in the body, and then we're strengthening it every time we do it. And you have definitely noticed that there's this dance of forgetting and remembering that goes on, to quote my first teacher, Vinnie Ferraro, who's a good friend of Spirit Rock. The dance of forgetting and remembering. We're in the body, we're relaxing, it feels good, and then thought comes up, we get snagged by a story, right? The basic function of mindfulness is to just come back, come back, come back. And every time we do that, we're practicing and strengthening our ability. We're wiring in an ability to live from the body rather than fantasy. There's a question here, please. Oh, right, right. Yes, I've been a party to this as well. Thank you.
So does this correlate with that notion of flow that people talk about, that as artists and perhaps athletes as well get into a mode where through practice and doing and experiencing, that right side of the brain is then being utilized, and that flow state, which causes this euphoria, is that mm-hmm. the same as it being this non-linguistic but... Yeah. Symbolic part. Is
yeah.
that it?
Yeah. I've not studied flow states or what do they call it? Peak experiences. However, the little bit that I do know, I would say yes. Because the experiences I've heard of are always, it was quiet, there wasn't a thought going on in my head. Right? But there's a little bit more to flow states, from what I understand, that they also involve some level of challenge and difficulty, but not so much that you flip over into freak out. So that there's that level 7 growth edge as well. And there's another variable that's present around what the experience means to you. So it's not just that you're doing anything. It's that you're doing something that you're emotionally invested in as well. There's other variables to the ability to enter into flow state, but yeah, we're talking about a state of radical presence where I'm wholly invested in what's actually going on. Yeah, please.
Hi. You had said something, I think it might have been this morning, which caught my attention. It also catches my attention in my practice, and that's people being born sensitive. So with neuroplasticity, can any of that, and those are the people that I see in my office, actually.
Okay.
People that are born very sensitive.
Yeah.
Can neuroplasticity change some of that sensitivity? And why do you think, or can you direct me in a way, somewhere where I could read about that? It fascinates me.
Yeah. Yeah. So the work of Richard Davidson, the work of Dan Siegel, the work of Rick Hansen, all really good places to begin in terms of learning about neuroplasticity from a Buddhist point of view. Richard Davidson. Richard Davidson is the person who began putting Tibetan Buddhist monks in fMRI machines at the behest of the Dalai Lama. He is kind of the epicenter of this entire mindfulness movement that we're seeing spread so beautifully. One moment, we'll come right back. But so with regards to highly sensitive people, the authentic answer is I don't know. What I believe I can logically posit is each of us are born with a temperament, that comes from genetics, that comes from, that, you know, there's a lot of variables involved. And and I think that there's some things about us that are just enduring traits. I'll tell you why I say that. So I've dropped it a couple of times that intimate relationships are a sticking point for me. Right, the rest of my life is like this beautiful flowing work of art, and intimacy is just a disaster. And I am in therapy still, going, why isn't this changing? I've done the work, man. I have done the work. And, you know, and some things have improved. If anybody knows what attachment theory is, I was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder at one time, because I have what's called disorganized attachment. I pull people in and then I can't stand them, but I don't want them to go. And it's hell. I wouldn't meet the criteria for that diagnosis of borderline personality anymore, thank God. So that's changed, and it's changed to a great degree. But the fact of the matter is that the variables that set that up were the very air that I breathed for 18 years of my life. It is just in there. It was constant. It wasn't like one event that happened. It was like ongoing. And I have one of these annoying psychoanalysts who won't tell me the answer to anything. You know, it's just, well, is this ever going to change? Well, it seems like it's important to you that it changes. Can you tell me a little more about that? Why won't you tell me anything? Well, it seems like you really want some answers from me. I wonder what's going on there. So where I'm at with him is, you know, some things about us are enduring. You can take the air out of the tire, but you maybe won't lose the tire. You know what I mean? What we can always do is develop choices around it. And so for highly sensitive people, there is actually a growing body of research and knowledge out there around how somebody can make sensible choices, set boundaries, figure out what's going on, the inner dynamics of that come with that temperament. So I hope that's helpful. I believe you had a question over here.
Yeah, I lost it.
Well, if you find it, let me know. So, what's the power of working with the body? Okay, we'll do one more. We'll do one more, and then we got to move.
Thanks. You talked a lot about like wanting, and for me, it seems like the antidote to like that suffering, that, you know, grasping and wanting is just acceptance, accepting yourself, accepting situations that you can't control. But the big problem that I find I personally have is that I feel like if I get to a point where I feel like I can really accept like the scenario or myself, it feels like this sort of fire to like try to improve myself goes away too. And I'm always worried that like, you know, I'm getting complacent or I'm accepting myself too much. Is that like a real thing?
Yeah. It's interesting how delusion is really like capitalism. It can co-opt anything. It really can, you know? Even self-love can take on a tone of self-hate, you know? I love myself, so I'm going to change this about myself because I really don't love that part of me, right? Positive vibes only. But what about the reality of that negative vibes are part of the experience of life? Or even loving kindness, right? Sometimes we practice loving kindness for our enemies, and there can be a sense of like, yeah, may you be happy. You know? Yeah, I hope you get free. So I know that the most powerful and direct way to work with an experience that's difficult is to just be with it directly, not trying to fix it, not trying to heal it, not trying to spiritualize it, just to really meet it in the body and be there with it. But then there's sometimes that I'll really meet it in the body and be there with it so I can heal it and fix it, right? There's like this, I call it the hall of mirrors, right? That we can enter into this territory where it's very hard to tell what's what. And the only antidote is really just practice and repetition and familiarity with your own mind. And then having the honesty and the earnestness to be able to discern in moments like that. So the real answer to your question is only you know. It's one of these intuitive areas where we could be deceiving ourselves or we could be authentic, right? Is it neurotic to want? You know, the answer is it depends. You have a look on your face like I'm not answering your question.
It's like a somewhat tepid, unsatisfying answer.
You're out. Please, can we have the microphone back, please? Thank you.
Well, I'm just responding to the crowd, but for me
it's a juggling act, you know. Sometimes you know, when you're at that like level 8, level 9 neuroticism, you need to go like 10, 11 with acceptance and love for yourself. And then, you know, when you feel empowered and strong, then you can really start pushing yourself. And so, you know, I really vacillate in that hall of mirrors. You know, I'll look at the mirrors that I really need to when I feel like I'm suffering. And then, you know, if I feel, you know, confident and empowered, which, you know, I do a lot of days, then I'll really be like, hey, you know, we could really work on that and you can push yourself today. So let's do that.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's a better answer than what you said, but it's how I do it.
Yes. Yeah. So I think a lot of the questions that are in the room, and certainly this one, I think tomorrow when we get to parts work from internal family systems therapy, and we really start engaging with the emotional selves, plural, that we all have living inside of us, I think the answer you're looking for will actually come from your own intuition. So that's also me squirming out of it.
Hey, I'm just being honest.
Yeah, no, I appreciate your honesty. I do. So let's talk about the breath a little bit more, and we're going to do some breathwork practices to close today out. So, I gave you all some excerpts from my book that my editor has not seen, by the way. Enter at your own risk. But this, in the interest of time, there's this page that says how you breathe is how you feel. I think I can just bullet point this for us rather than reading these four pages. And then if you want to, you can review it at home. But So with the breath, like I said earlier, it's connected to the nervous system. We can employ it voluntarily. We can use that to affect our nervous system at the autonomic level, which is amazing. What's really interesting is there was a set of studies done by these European psychologists who wanted to see if there was a specific breathing pattern for every emotion. Because if you think about it, laughing is a form of breath, right? Crying is a form of breath, right? There's an emotional quality to breath. And so they studied fear. Where is it? The They studied joy, anger, sadness, and fear. And they took people who were in those natural emotional states, watched their breathing patterns, and they found that there was a direct correlation, that fear has its own breathing pattern, that that happiness has its own breathing pattern, etc. Right? And then they did something really interesting, which is they turned it around. And they said, okay, can we have people breathe, you know, this breathing pattern we just discovered that correlates to sadness. Can we have people breathe in that way? Or anger? Can we have people breathe in that way? And they walk in feeling fine, and then suddenly they're sad or they're angry because they're breathing in a particular way. Right? So the breath reflects our emotional state, and we can also use the breath to induce an emotional state. Isn't that wild?
Yeah.
So wild. So... And so the Tibetans say you need two wings to fly. There's kind of always two things at least going on in any situation. And here I'll say that, you know, there's a value to knowing how to use the breath purposely and intentionally. And there's also a value in what we did in the meditation before, which is just learn how to let it go and let it do its own thing. Both have value and both impact the nervous system. It just really depends on your context. And so what I would like to do is explore some breathwork practices, because when we do our mindfulness practices going forward, I'm going to ask you all to choose a breathwork that feels right for you. And it'll be one of these, or if you have one that you already know works for you that's different from these, you're welcome to do it. But I want to give us three breathworks, one for energizing, one for relaxing, and one for balancing. Right? In Ayurveda, they say opposites are medicine. Right? We always want to be going towards balance. And so if you're too heavy on one side, you want to find something that'll bring you to the other. Right? If I'm too anxious, I want to relax more. If I'm too relaxed, I need to ratchet up the effort. And if I'm magically in the middle or somewhere in the vicinity of the middle, we want to find a way to keep that. Right? So giving you relaxing breath work in case you're over-caffeinated, right? or anxious or just agitated, an energizing one for when you're sleepy, and one that's just in the middle. So let's talk about them, and then we'll actually do them, and then we'll talk about them. We'll take them one at a time, okay? So the first is a relaxing breath work. And this one comes from Dr. Andrew Weil, who is the most prominent holistic health person on the planet who isn't full of shit. What's that? There are many forms of measured breathing. I like this one. It's 4-7-8. So we're going to breathe in for the count of 4. We're going to hold for 7. We're going to breathe out for the count of 8. Okay. I have lots to say about it, but let's just practice it together. So just get comfortable. No special postures needed. Might be nice to close your eyes and just kind of drop in. So we'll breathe in for the count of 4 through the nose. We'll hold for 7 and then out of the mouth for 8. So we'll go a little bit quicker in the beginning because that's a long time without taking a breath for some of us. And then I'll slow it down a couple minutes into this. Just go ahead and take a deep breath and let it go. And breathing in through the nose for 1, 2, 3, 4, and hold 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Exhale through the mouth. 3, 4, five, six, seven, eight. Inhale, two, three, four. Hold, one, two, three, four, five, six, seven. Exhale, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. Inhale, two, three, four. Hold, one, two, three, four, five, six, seven. Exhale, four, five, six, seven, eight. Inhale, two, three, four. Hold, two, three, four, five, six, seven. Exhale, four, five, six, seven, eight. Inhale, two, three, four. Hold, one. Exhale, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. Inhale, hold. Exhale. Inhale, hold. Exhale. Inhale. 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 Hold. Exhale. One more. Inhale. Hold. Exhale. Five, six, seven, eight. And let the breath return to its natural rhythm. And be open to the soothing effects, which might be a bit subtle. Come back when you're ready. I had a consultation recently with a gentleman who's building a mindfulness app, and has really gotten into mindfulness meditation through, you know, the kind of emergent culture around it. He said, am I missing anything? And I said, yeah, breath work is really important. And he was like, breath work, what's that? And I was like, oh my God. You know, this somehow this stuff kind of gets left out, the controlled breathing exercises, and I think that they're really important.
So with life, how are you using that?
What's that?
In real life.
Yeah.
So cutting myself down. So you imagine that at the office I go to different sit down, and how you apply it in real life?
Yeah, yeah, that's what I'm getting to. So this is a really good one to start our meditation practice with. Most of us, especially New Yorkers, tend to be on the agitated side of the spectrum at the onset. But I think that exists here in Marin County as well. Right, so at the onset of a meditation practice, wonderful. I like to lay down first, do some breathwork practice, maybe see if there's any emotional processing that needs to be done. And then I have a second bell on insight timer that goes off, and then it's time to sit up and do a more formal sitting practice. That's just my personal process. Now, this is a really good breath work that will, with repetition and regularity, begin to rewire your nervous system. But the repetition and regularity is crucial. Now, breath work is often taught for folks who have anxiety or panic attacks. And there is something that's missing sometimes when they're taught. And that is, you have to practice this stuff when you're feeling okay. You have to practice it and get familiarity with it when you're in a somewhat regulated state. And then when you're having an anxious moment, you'll have it in your back pocket to use to help settle you a little bit and get you more towards the 7 and out of the 8 or 9, right? Right, so thank you. 2.5 minutes, at least. We did about 3 just now. I don't know why, but something about the 2.5 minute mark is where the nervous system really starts to register the practice. And how this is calming is we're taking a good deep breath, right? Good. We're holding, so we're allowing the oxygen to absorb into the lungs. And then any time your exhale is longer than your inhale, you're starting to slow down your heart, which is then going to have an effect on the nervous system, and then on and on down the line of dominoes. Anytime your exhale is longer than your inhale, you're slowing down your heart rate. And if you can, the rule of thumb is if you can get your breath cycles to 6 or less per minute. So if you do the math, that's a 5-second inhale, 5-second exhale would be 6 breath cycles per minute. So you want a little bit longer than that, and this accomplishes that quite nicely. But there's something about the breath being slowed to that rate, that's when it starts having a meaningful impact on the heart rate, on the nervous system. Now, let's say you're in an engaged situation and anxiety comes up, you get stressed out, you're in a situation where you can't just be with that stress or that anxiety, you're at work, you got to perform, etc. I answered a question over the lunch break that was quite similar. Here's the bad news. Anytime you're in an afflicted state, there's pretty much nothing you can do that will not cause more harm if you're blended with that feeling state, if you're in your anger, if you're in your anxiety. Everything that flows out from it is going to add more layers of confusion, right? You can prevent, like if you think about an emotional state following that wave, right? And the beginning of that wave would be what's called a revving period, where the trigger has happened and we're starting to enter into affliction. That's where we can meaningfully impact emotions and have a lot of agency over their course. Once you get to the peak of that, too late. Too late. The only thing I know that you can do is find a way to stop. That's it. You know, when I was in rehab, they would say, if you get a craving, just sit absolutely still. Don't move a muscle. And there's no way you'll relapse. Now, I'll come back to you in just a moment, right? But we have to find a way to stop. So what that can look like, when I worked in social service agencies, I would just go to the bathroom. Ain't nobody gonna, you know, fault me for being in the bathroom for a few minutes. You know, even if we're having a meeting, I can excuse myself to the restroom, right? Arguing with a lover on the phone, right? And the argument gets to that place where you don't even know what you're fighting about anymore. You just really need to be right. That place, just, hey, can we just get off the phone for 5 minutes here? Can I call you back in 5 minutes? And then take a break. Do some breathing, even just big, deep breaths until there's a sense of space. You'll recover your sanity. And then you come back to the conversation. If you live with your partner, and I'm using intimate relationships as the prime example because that's where we get triggered the most, isn't it? That and work.
Teenagers.
What's that?
And teenagers.
And okay, sure, teenagers. Well, that's a form of an intimate relationship, right? In a different way, very very close. And then I was about to say, and then the daily Google search. Trump, and then Trump, Russia, and then North Korea, and then hurricane. Those are my four. It's terrible. Terrible. So devoted to our suffering, really.
This is kind of a cousin of EMDR, because it gets the left brain and the right brain. So if you're, and something I learned, if you're in a meeting and you can get away with it, to put your hands on your knees and just tap back and forth, because it engages both sides of your brain.
Nice.
It can be a soothing.
Nice.
You can do it under your table.
Yeah.
So if you're in a meeting and, you know, you get past the stage of getting overly excited, you can put your hands, a hand on each knee, and take your two fingers on each of your hands and tap back and forth, and because it engages both sides of your brain, and it helps you relax without being really obvious. Yeah.
Mm. Okay. Yeah. We had one more question over here, and we'll wait for the mic. See, I'm getting the hang of this.
I feel like you might have been talking about this, but then I have different terminology,
sure.
So I just want to ask it with my terminology. So also you refer to substance addictions, but I'm thinking more about like obsessive thinking that can be an addictive patterning. So I also really like to do shadow work, which I think is a really good thing, but then I don't really know when is it the healthy shadow work and not avoiding that and actually doing that work. And then when is it like digging in deeper the neural wiring? And if there's like a certain, because then by the time I realize that, it's too late, mm-hmm. and the neural wiring has already been impacted and enhanced. So is there a body sensation or something that one could look out for to know when you're in that realm of healthy self-work versus the unhealthy adding to your neural wiring?
Right. Yeah. When are we showing up for therapy and just kind of mulling over the same story and actually deepening that neural pathway,
mm-hmm.
right? Or actually just becoming like so inward and so self-obsessed, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And obsessive compulsive thinking is really like from a certain vantage point, narcissism, right? Because it's all self-referential. It's just another way of thinking about me, me, me. Depression, in a way, is also very narcissistic. It's all about woe is me and how bad it is for me and how I'm not good enough or how everybody has it better or how there's no hope for me, and it's all me. That's not the only cause. It's just an element, right? And yeah, and being on the spiritual path or the path of healing trauma, which I think are synonymous, there is a place where we can flip over and almost like being in a like domestic violence relationship, like our brain gets kind of addicted to going to these uncomfortable places, right? There's a huge correlation between domestic violence and addiction and brain chemistry and what the brain gets accustomed to and then will, in a subtle way, long for later. But your question, again, this is another one that is in the realm of where I look like I'm just trying to weasel my way out of the question of only you can tell. With so much of this work, and this is where the principles of honesty and earnestness really come in, because if we are not completely honest with others and honest with ourselves, we're going to hit a point in our practice, a therapeutic, spiritual, or otherwise, where there is this subtle, nuanced territory of am I over here on this side or am I over here on this side? It's the near enemy. Is what it's called, right? So like compassion and codependence is a really good example of near enemies, right? They look and feel very, very similar. One is toxic and one is very healthy, right? That was a huge thing to drop in this room without unpacking, but, you know, because they're both about other people and putting aside your own needs and thinking of somebody else first and feeling into their pain and et cetera, except codependence has this element of guilt to it and fear, like if I don't do this for you, then, you know, what are you going to think of me or how are you ever going to be okay, whatever. So it's the near enemy. And so there's a way in which we could do shadow work in as the near enemy of actual shadow work, right? That we could do narcissistic shadow work. Shadow work is something that will, it's another way of saying going inside and meeting your trauma or meeting your inner child, working with hurts to build a better relationship with them.
Or like when you were saying that when you get the heroin or cigarette cravings, that you sit with it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, but when you're sitting with your thoughts or sitting trying to heal the trauma or the relationships or something. So, yeah.
The only piece of advice I have is keep going. Seriously. If we are honest and earnest with ourselves, all we have to do is keep going and trusting our experience. If you can trust your experience, and if you are deluded, but you're honest and earnest in your efforts, you're going to figure that out. And not only will you figure it out, you'll learn from having been deluded for some time.
Okay. I like that answer. Thank you.
Yay. I get a gold star. I love that y'all are really so curious about the emotional piece, and that's exciting to me. So let's stay with the breath piece, since that's where we are. So let's do an energizing breathwork practice, of which there are many. We're going to do 12-fold belly breathing, which this is a really nice one to do laying down. I lament that we cannot, however, it still has a great effect when sitting up. So just close your eyes, drop in, and for this one, do make sure your spine is straighter. Back of the head is lifted. Just a sense of the bones of the spine and the head are moving upwards, while the musculature of the body is allowed to relax downwards. Like a towel hanging from a hook. You will have to endure some anatomical language here. But just start taking deep breaths down to the low belly, like we did before, beneath the navel a couple of inches, but above the pubic bone. And you want to take a deep breath so that it puffs out, lower belly puffs out, and then bring your belly back to exhale, but this time a bit forcefully, like you're trying to touch your navel to your spine, and exhale, exhale, everything out. And then relax the belly, another full breath in, down to the belly, really filling it up. And again, exhaling everything out. You might even have a little bit left in the mouth that you want to get rid of. Good. So this time, breathe in, let the belly fill. And now you're going to exhale and you're going to tighten the anal sphincter and pull the perineum, which is just in front of it, up and into the body as you exhale. And then relax and take a deep breath in. And then again, bringing the belly back and the perineum in, like you're trying to get the perineum to meet the navel, which is impossible. And then relax the whole thing. So this is it. We're going to do 11 more from here. Question real quick. Belly in, perineum up every time. Every time.
And that's on the holding breath?
As you're exhaling. And yeah, and you can hold it out for a couple seconds. And then relaxing.
What's the perineum?
The perineum is the region between your genitals and your anus. Yay. Yeah, you're welcome. You're welcome. Also known as the pelvic floor.
Breathing in.
In this one, we actually want to breathe out through the nose. Breathing out through the mouth is fine, though. Breathing out through the mouth is fine. But this one, you can experiment with either. They both impact the nervous system in the same way. Don't breathe in through the mouth, though. That's a little different. Any more? Cool. All right. So let's drop in. Let the belly fill. And navel moves towards the spine. Perineum comes up to meet it. Breathing in. Keep going. What you're going to notice is that you'll breathe in better if you just completely relax. And that it takes some effort to breathe out, to lift the pelvic floor. Keep going. But the pelvic floor will get stronger as you go. And the belly will be able to fill even more with every inhale. Just keep going. If you've already finished, just keep going. Do three more. And then just let go of the technique entirely and relax. Be in the body, in the torso, down in the limbs. And then we'll do another round. So breathing in. Every time we exhale, anything that's stale and stuck can make its way out. We're breathing in, relaxing. And then an honest effort as you breathe out with no straining, but some vigor. Breathing in. So just keep going at your own pace. A couple more for good measure. And relax. Be with the pulsing, be with the tingling. Take a breath and come back to the room. Ideally, we would have done another round, but that can be a lot. And I also don't want us to fly away, get too lightheaded. You look like you have a question. There can be like a like movement in the hips that kind of assists that inward outward motion. Yeah.
I also felt.
Yeah, that's what we're doing. Okay. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
So the trick question is: okay. If you did this with an in breath of 4 and an out breath of 8, even though this is the invigorating, then does that trick this?
Remember when you were a kid and you would go to the soda machine and try to get all the flavors in one cup? That's what you're trying to do, huh? You're mixing the root beer and the Dr. Pepper and the Mountain Dew. Right. One at a time, please.
Should be careful to go even 4 and 4 or whatever.
You could measure it. I'm not against that. But there's enough going on with this, don't you think? You're a type A, New York type, aren't you?
I'm from Florida.
Right. Yeah. So, you know. I'm not an idealist. I'm a choose-your-own-adventure kind of person, so...
Well, it felt that the out-breath was longer, so then I was wondering...
Yeah.
Up and down.
Yeah. I can't speak to that with any level of knowingness, because this is one that's more from the tantric tradition that I don't have science on. So, any questions, comments, or concerns with that one? Oh, right, right. Thank you.
Does this differ from the practice of Kapalabhati? Is it the pacing?
Yeah.
Because I find myself, that's a practice, so I find myself kind of falling into that.
Kapalabhati
is
excellent.
Pacing is significant.
This is So this is slower, much slower than Kapalabhati. Kapalabhati is quick. Yeah. We're engaging some of the same regions. You're not necessarily engaging the pelvic floor, the Mula Bandha, in Kapalabhati, though I've heard that's recommended at times. But this is also a deeper pulling in of the navel. And it's less of a passive inhale. With Kapalabhati, which is a, for those of you who don't know, is a short, sharp, pulsing exhale, active exhale, and then the inhale is completely passive. You're just expanding the belly and the air just comes in. And this, we're making a little bit more effort with the inhale. And really, Kapalabhati is going to impact... It's skull shining breath is what Kapalabhati means, and it's going to impact the energetic region right back here. And really, this practice is we're squeezing in on the digestive organs and the lower organs in the abdomen, and which is going to help clean it out. And also, it's going to squeeze the organs so that stale blood that's trapped there. Can come out and then our organs can receive fresh blood. But really, we're just taking in a lot of oxygen and we're engaging the lower body and breaking up stale energy, which lots of emotional stuff tends to get trapped here in the low belly, in the region of the hips and the pelvis. And so we're breaking up all of that on an energetic level. So it's a little different than Kapalabhati.
Yeah, thank you. That's helpful.
Yeah, yeah.
First exercise, I was thinking of Nadi Sudhi, and to me that just seemed, I'm familiar with that, and the first exercise seemed
that's
like
what we're
that.
Doing next.
Oh, that wasn't the first one.
No.
Because you breathe in half as much as you breathe out on Nadi Sudhi. So.
Yeah, so, which is one way of doing Nadi Shodhana. We're going to do, or to clue everybody in, Nadi Shodhana is alternate nostril breathing, which is next up. That's our balancing breath work. And that one you can do as a measured breath work and add in counts. I'm going to give us a way simpler version, like the most like Nadi Shodhana for a dummies version of the practice. Yeah, but you
You could. I don't see why not. But again, mixing up the flavors. Mixing up the flavors, right?
I have...
What's that?
I was getting hyperventilated
Interesting. Okay. Well, I'm putting the balancing one last because I know that this is a lot of breath work. How's everybody feeling? Can you say it into the microphone, please?
I really didn't feel comfortable with the perineum part.
Mm-hmm.
Am I bringing it up externally or internally?
Internally.
Okay. Internally. Thanks. Thank you.
I have to say how I know this knowledge, if it's correct. We had our first child with the Lamaze technique.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the teachers was teaching my wife that this sounds like the exercise to rebuild and strengthen the walls of the vagina.
Mm-hmm.
Is that similar? Is that good?
Right.
Is it?
Similar.
Similar.
Little different.
Yeah. If you had a baby, it feels like bearing down. Have you had a baby?
Right. I'm yet to have one.
I actually had an observation. I felt like it was similar to Tonglen. So you're in Tonglen, you all might be familiar with it, but you're breathing in sort of negative states or feelings or about others or yourself, mm-hmm. or whatever, and then breathing out positive energy. And I kind of felt like that. And I also felt the urge to laugh. I don't know why.
Mm.
But something hit my funny bone.
I'll take it. I'm curious how that felt like Tonglen. That's really interesting. Maybe it's just an association.
Well, when I've done it before, and I've done it sort of with guided, it's been. I felt like it was similar to that, where you're breathing. You're breathing in, and normally you want to always think positive thoughts and all that, but it's sort of the opposite of what would be intuitive, like to heal yourself, I guess, to some people. But breathing in this and then just letting everything go and just sort of having these, like changing it in your body and then letting it out as positive energy, sort of.
The alchemical aspect. So
yeah.
What we're talking about is a compassion-building meditation wherein you feel the suffering of others on the in-breath and you exhale the space of compassion, which will be an element in some of our practices tomorrow. There's this alchemical aspect of like you're breathing in the suffering, but it's actually transforming into compassion through your willingness to meet it in the body. So that's an interesting association.
I didn't explain it very well.
Yeah, you're fine. Can we pass the mic up?
Is there a name for this last breathing?
12-fold belly breathing is the only thing I've ever heard it called. I wish there was a sexier name for it. But that's what we got. 12-fold. And these are all actually outlined in your handout. So if you forget. All right. So 9-fold clearing is next up. Yeah, let's do the 9-fold clearing, and then we're at the end of the day. It's, you know, most of us are feeling quite cooked. Yeah, so we'll just have some quiet meditation after the 9-fold clearing practice. Okay. So let's just take a meditative posture right at the onset. Beginning with the earth and the parts of your body that are connected to the earth and just sensing that support. Plugging in. lengthening the spine, straightening the back of the neck by lifting the top tips of the ears directly upwards. The chin will come in just a little bit. Shoulders balanced, hands placed, tongue relaxed. Always and forever, we begin by doing nothing except noticing how things already are with us. So just be as you are. Check in with that. And just a reminder that it's always going to be about love. It's always going to be about warmth and caring over and over again. If we're missing that piece, all we'll ever be doing in our practice is just sitting still. In a moment, we'll begin the Ninefold Clearing, or Nadi Shodhana. And what we'll do is you'll bring your left index finger up to your left nostril. You won't close it off, but we'll breathe in through both nostrils, and then you'll close the left nostril and exhale through the right. And we'll do that for a total of 3 times, breathing in through both nostrils, exhaling through the right. Then we'll take a natural breath and just relax for 1 breath cycle. And then we'll switch, we'll do the right. We'll breathe in through both, close off the right nostril with the right index finger, and then we'll relax for 1 breath after 3 repetitions of that. And then we'll do 3 breaths through both nostrils with this intention of clearing the inner body. And I'll instruct this as we go, but we want to have a little push at the end of each exhale. But you don't have to remember that right now. So bring your left index finger to the left nostril. And take a nice full breath through both nostrils. Close off the left and breathe out the right. And then at the end of the exhale, a little push. And then breathing in through both. Breathing out the right. And fresh, light energy coming in through the inhale. And stale, stagnant energy leaving through the exhale. And then just chill out for 1 breath. Right index finger to right nostril, breathing in through both. Breathing out of the left. Inhaling. Exhaling. Same thing 1 more time. Relax. Breathing through both nostrils and out of both. 3 times. Just be open to whatever effect this wants to have on the body. And then find your breath. I'll give you 2 options. You can either stay at the tip of the nose if that feels good. If you need to get further away from the head, you can follow the breath down in the belly, the gentle rising and falling of the belly, and you can even place 2 hands at the low belly, so that you're really working with the sensations in your hands as the belly rises and falls. It can be quite nice. So choose your own adventure. But once you decide, stay there through this practice. And let the love affair begin. Allowing there to be gaps between breaths. Allowing the breath to drive the car. Presence is an actively receptive state. A deep listening takes some intention, but it's not generative. It's relaxing and opening. The effort is simply in maintaining that. Which is easier. And then return to the breath. The only reality that is present is you are a body breathing quietly in a quiet room. How much can you be here for that? How much can you open to that? And opening the aperture of the mind one more time, considering the life that surrounds you. Everybody with birthdays and bank accounts and difficult relationships with their families and fever dreams and great heartaches. The whole thing, just like you. That's everyone around you. And then we'll take a moment to consider that that is actually every living being on this planet. The entire planet is teeming with life forms that consistently go towards what feels good and away from what feels bad. All beings wanting to be happy and to not suffer. So please join me in emanating a wish out into the world that may any of the merits, the positive momentum that we have generated here with our efforts today, may it spread out like the most beautiful ripple effect ever, out into the world to nourish sentient beings everywhere. May all beings be happy. May the darkness of ignorance and fear and greed be dispelled. May all beings awaken to their true nature, that which is limitless joy. There's just a few announcements, and then I will set you all free. One is that we are on retreat, technically, even though everybody will go home to their lives and laptops and families, etc. So do as you wish, but if you could maintain a sense of continuity, that what you are doing at home is not so different from what you're doing here in terms of practicing presence, in terms of working with the mind, in terms of returning to the body. This means nothing if it doesn't spill out into our daily lives, right? Then there's definitely a possibility of 1 month from now it being like you never took this weekend at all. That happens way too much in this culture. And so to integrate, I just really want to encourage that, you know, even if you have plans to go to a show or whatever tonight, can you bring this into that realm? Even if you're going to a bar, can you bring a bodily awareness and a willingness to return to the present moment over and over again into those situations? Bullet point number two, if you look to the handout, the very first page after the cover page of the handout. So in the spirit of that continuity, I would like to encourage us all to do something I call 5-3-1-1, because I just haven't come up with a better name for it. This is a really nice way to wake up, to set the emotional tone for your day, because just as breakfast is the most important meal because you will feel the residue of that meal throughout the day, same thing with the mind and body. Nutrition comes in many forms, right? So the practice is easy. You either loll in bed an extra 5 minutes, or if you know that you're going to pass back out, you can just sit up in bed or sit on the side of your bed. And you take 5 big, deep breaths. And then you think of 3 things that you're grateful for. 1 lobotomized smile. And then set an intention for the day. Just how are you going to show up? Just set that intention. Hopefully you do this before checking your phone. If you know you're going to check your phone, make a reminder on your way out that pops up right whenever you're going to wake up. 5-3-1-1. 5 deep breaths, 3 gratitudes, 1 smile, 1 intention. Okay? Last bullet point. Tomorrow, we will do some of the supine meditation we explored in the morning. We'll be doing some of that tomorrow towards the end of the day. So we will have big canvas tarps, so you don't have to worry about laying directly on the grass or ticks. If some of you are nervous about ticks, then some tick spray or bug repellent rather would not be a bad idea. It's bumpy. It's nature, you know. There's gopher holes and dry grass and the whole thing. So if you want to bring a yoga mat or a pillow, we can't use the pillows or yoga mats here out there. So if you want to bring some gear with you to make that a more cozy ride, cool. If not, if you're down with nature and bumpiness like I am, that's also cool, obviously. We'll be out there for about an hour. and so you may want to bring sunscreen or a hat as well.
What time of day?
We're going to go out there about 3:30. So the last hour of our day tomorrow, and then we'll actually be starting back there on day 3. So if it's not too cold in the morning. So if you do bring extra gear to make it a cozier ride, then you can leave it here, and it'll be here for day 3 as well. Sound good?
So,
what's that?
Are we in the other building tomorrow?
No. We're here.
Parking is different.
Is it? Did everybody get that? Is everyone aware of the parking situation? I don't have a license even, so can we have the microphone maybe? and just pass it up here so everybody can hear. Would you mind announcing that for us again into the mic? Thank you. I'm putting
this
you to work
here. The instructions that Nancy and I were given when we drove in, because when we drove in, we parked at the first left-hand parking lot. And I guess probably, oh, and because there are two more all-day retreats, apparently, tomorrow, so they want us to go up to the second parking lot, which is off to the right. I'm sure somebody will be there to direct us again tomorrow, yeah. But that's what they told us today.
Cool. Thank you for that. With that, I bid you adieu. Have a lovely night, and I'll see you back here at 9:30 tomorrow.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.